You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The following podcast contains spoilers. We strongly recommend you watch the episode of The Americans we're discussing before listening to the podcast. New episodes air Wednesdays at 10 p.m. on FX.
Having a wife and a child back is a good anchor. On the other hand, having the wife with you hopefully wouldn't make you go astray the way I did. So there's no ideal situation to keep an illegal forever.
And welcome to Slate's TV Club Insider Podcast for Season 4 of The Americans. I'm June Thomas, a writer and editor at Slate, and I'm the host of the podcast in which we take you behind the scenes and share some of these secrets in the making of the show. I've returned once again to gorgeous Gowanus, Brooklyn, where the show is made to discuss Episode 2 of Season 4, Pastor Tim. Today I'll be joined by Joe Weisberg, the creator of the show. Hello, Joe.
Hi, June.
And his co-showrunner and co-executive producer, Joel Fields. Hello, Joel.
Hey, how are you?
And we have a really exciting special guest, a real-life illegal, as agents like Philip and Elizabeth were known, Jack Barsky. Jack, thank you so much for coming and joining us on the podcast.
I'm glad to join you. Guten Tag.
Guten Tag. Now, I just want to have one quick question before we get to Jack. We had a crazy scene in this episode of Philip cold killing a transit cop. This guy, are you still telling me he's not just a psychopathic murderer?
You gotta stop calling him a psychopath. First of all, Jack's right here. Jack was an illegal. Jack doesn't look like a psychopath, does he?
He does not. He's a very charming
guy. And Jack, how many people did you kill on buses? Probably like 10, 11 people?
No, these hands have never touched a weapon.
Well, even in training?
Even in training, never touched a weapon. Huh. No weapons training, only some self-defense.
Well,
of course, Philip didn't use a weapon for this particular murder. Jack hasn't seen it yet. But,
no.
But what choice?
Provoked him. Totally provoked him.
I mean, how many
times?
Yeah,
you can't have that.
Exactly. Even Jackson. How many times can Philip just tell the guy to please cut them a break and let them go about their day? I mean, I think actually that transit cop was suicidal, obviously.
Yeah.
He really did try to get out of it.
I feel sorry for Philip.
I feel sorry for the bus driver who's got to drive around with that corpse under his seat. You know, we spent a lot of time trying to choose the right bus for that. Trying to get a bus from the early 80s is quite a project. Where did we send Will out?
Our Will, who was Chris Long, the brilliant director of that episode and our directing producer this season, his assistant, Will, actually went out for a half a day somewhere to look at all the buses.
There's a guy who collects buses from the like 70s and 80s.
He's got like a guy for everything.
Park with like 50 buses from that era.
Joe and I became obsessed with getting the right bus, and we talked how long it should be, how big it should be, what era it should be from. And then one day, we were working on something completely different. We set out to take a walk to talk about a story, and we got a half a block, and suddenly we stopped, and there was our bus.
Wow.
It was just sitting there.
We initially thought it would be one of those little shorty buses, like, you know, the kind that you see a lot around airports. And then Chris Long, the director, was like, I don't think I can accomplish that murder on that small of a bus. I'm going to have to sort of stretch the bus. Yeah. But then if you see it, that bus is so great, and that guy slides under the seat so well. See, we're avoiding the sociopath question.
Yeah, I see that.
We're really just more interested in the bus.
Well, see, I was sure that the crazy authenticity quest in this episode would have been the uniforms of the pilot and maybe even the transit cop.
Well, that was a crazy authenticity quest. Which East European country should that pilot be from? We wanted a pilot who they could ask to carry a biological weapon for the KGB. Maybe Jack is going to chime in here, because we thought, should he go to these Germans? Because should he go to the Czechs? Uh-huh. Should he go to Hungary? What country would they get the pilot from? And then we had to also find one that we wanted to find a country that would be flying in and out of Dulles. And it turned out there weren't any. So that's why we had to set it at JFK. And what country was the pilot flying in?
I don't remember. All I remember is that our brilliant casting director, Roy Bergman, almost quit because we were so bananas about getting the accent exactly right. It had to be a real accent. It couldn't be somebody who could do the accent. We needed someone who's from
place. Yeah. And then we realized you couldn't see where the uniform was from, and it was never mentioned in episode.
The whole thing was basically in our heads. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of that. Before we get to Jack, one other question about Crazy Authenticity Quest. I noticed that so you've got the...
CAQ. We should call it CAQ.
CAQ, thank you. When Elizabeth goes into Pastor Tim's hideaway where he writes his sermons. And of course, she found some C-Space information, which was a throwback for me. I was active in that area, and I was very familiar with the committee in El Salvador.
Yes.
With the people of El Salvador. Was that an actual leaflet from the time?
That was actually Philip, who was in his study, who finds
No, we made the CISPIS thing.
But the prop on the desk that we became obsessed with was actually Pastor Tim's calendar. Handwritten, of course, as you would not have a calendar today. And in addition to having a lot of church meetings and community action meetings that in a different color ink, in almost a different style of handwriting, because he would have done it all at once on December 31st or January 1st, are all the birthdays and anniversaries.
All right.
And my father, having been a congregational rabbi, had a calendar that would have been very much like Pastor Tim's. And it had all those committee meetings and all of his commitments, and then it had all the personal stuff.
We spend as much time on that calendar as we spend writing an entire script for this show. And then
I remember my dad once saying, at the end of every year, what is it you transfer from one calendar to the next? It's not the appointments, it's not the business meetings. Those are the things you worry about, but the things that you transfer, the things that matters, the birthdays, the anniversaries, and that's what you have to remember.
Oh my goodness.
Don't cut that out. Those are words to live by.
That's right.
Your amazing attention to detail would have come in handy. You would have been a great help in developing my cover story, my legend, because in hindsight, as I'm writing things down, I realize that there were a lot of holes in there that we didn't really think about and I didn't think about. There's a lot of talent there that might be tapped into one day.
Did it actually create problems for you sometimes?
No, not really. It was marginal. There were a couple of people who came up with question marks, but they never pursued them. For the most part, the cover story, who I was, who I had been until I finally actually appeared in the country, was more of a psychological benefit to me to have it. Just in case. People typically don't ask a lot of questions, especially if you stay away from people who might ask a lot of questions, which in the first two years, I didn't have any girlfriend or anything like that. So, and then I eased into society to a point where I then had enough of a history that I could sort of divert any questions and redirect them to talk about stuff that I already knew and experienced.
If somebody came up to you at a party and asked for some questions that you weren't necessarily prepared for, how would you sort of, what would you tell them? How would you respond? What kind of backstory would you give them?
Well, there's two parts to the answer. I am fundamentally wired to be like really, really honest. My mother would tell me stories about how I, as a child, she observed me playing. There was I played a game by myself with the little men running around the board with the dice, and I had teams, and she saw that I was like, I had my favorite team, and I was in pain when my team lost, but I would never cheat. So I'm fundamentally just like wired to tell the truth as I know it, which is not always a good thing. But anyway, so that way you believe such a person comes across much more credible. I'm also blessed with an extremely fast operating CPU, central processing unit. My brain operates at a speed that I can catch these things very quickly. Mm-hmm. like when you catch some of these really, really smart guys in the presidential debates, when they get caught, I never got caught like that. Uh-huh. You know, the unexpected question, I always had something. Uh-huh. And I didn't have to think about it, you know. Good question.
So, Jack, you were a real Philip Jennings. How did you come to be recruited?
Well, first of all, I have to show some humility. Philip Jennings is way out of my league. he is multi-talented, and you know he's an engineer. He's a spy. He's a marksman. He's everything.
And he's a hell of a travel agent too.
And he's better looking than me too. Yes. But anyway, the recruitment was really pretty straightforward. It was one day I was sitting in my dorm room in East Germany where I studied chemistry, and there was a knock on the door, and in came my roommate, by the way, wasn't conveniently not there that day. It was on a weekend. Mm. And some fellow came in and introduced himself as stating that he was an employee of the largest company that worked in the town where I studied, and he wanted to talk with me about maybe one day working for that company. The moment those words were out, Stasi came up in my mind. I mean, that was, speaking of bad covers, that was the worst, simply because in those days in East Germany, once you were finished with your degree, your assignment was essentially handled by the university. You know, companies didn't recruit. So, you know, I think Stasi, and I says, well, why not talk? You know, I had no reason to be concerned about Stasi whatsoever. So I left the door a little bit open. So we talked. And see, in the middle of the conversation, he changed his tune. He said, you know what? I have to come clean. I really work for the government. The government, right? Big brother, right? So that was even more Stasi. And so he said, okay, you know, I just wanted to feel you out. Maybe one day you could wind up working for the government, blah, blah, blah. And so at the end of the, we talked maybe for 45 minutes, he asked a question. It was an indirect question to which I gave a satisfactory indirect answer. He asked, well, do you think you could imagine that one day you might work for the government? And my answer was, maybe, but not as a chemist. Mm-hmm. Question not asked, but not really answered, but we both knew what that meant. It was between the lines communication. He had exactly what he came to get the answer for. And within a couple of meetings, he handed me over to a Russian. Mm. He didn't ask me. He didn't. Oh, by the way, this is Eugen. He's with the KGB.
Was that a surprise? Or
yes?
And was that? Did you care? Was that upsetting or didn't?
No,
matter?
It was great.
Yeah,
it was. Man,
moving up to the bigger leagues.
Big time. You bet.
Leagues.
I mean, yeah.
And then did your training continue in East Germany?
Yes, it did. For a while, it was very informal during my years while I was still working on my degree. And then once I decided, I had to make a decision, you know, which way are you going? Are you going to stay at university? None of that was ever coerced. It was all voluntary. So once I decided to go, and I already knew it would be the illegal route.
How did you know that? How did?
Oh, that was discussed very early on. Okay. There was sort of a precondition. I didn't want to do anything else. I mean, the only thing that would have gotten me away from this phenomenal career I was looking forward to was the adventure, the romantic mystique of the, you know, the lone wolf who does great things on behalf of the revolution to help mankind become a better place. It's so wonderfully attractive to a young person. And in addition, I would have been really, you know, it was a recognition that I was really somebody special. You know, just flattery gets you very far.
How do you think they picked you?
It's all guesswork. I have two friends who actually were working with the Stasi before I even was approached. They both claimed that they suggested me, but there's also a thought that they just picked me out of records because I was a recipient of a national scholarship. And as you know, the CIA always has traditionally recruited from the top Ivy League schools, and so did the Russians. They went to recruit the top folks out of university. So it could have been a combination of the two.
Now, Philip and Elizabeth never speak Russian, even with their handler in the United States. Was that also true of you? Did you exclusively communicate in English?
Primarily, yes. Some German. Funny thing, my liaison, I got 2 years of training in Moscow. My liaison actually spoke only German. He didn't speak English. For the most part, the folks that I worked with that, pointed me towards the United States, they had spent some time in the U.S. They spoke uh-huh. English. The technicians were mostly, they spoke only Russian. So that's where my handler just did the translation. But over time, I picked up enough Russian to understand most of it. There was no, I wasn't treated like a Russian. There was no intent for me to learn to speak Russian. Don't even do any of that. Mm. You're here to learn English.
So was it different for you being an East German? You think that they, did the KGB treat you differently? Were you on a...
I wouldn't know. I don't know how they treated yeah. Their own. I was treated fundamentally treated very well, with quite a bit of admiration. They bought into the mystique that they created themselves, the hero mm-hmm. undercover agent, and I was going to be one of those. And they were really impressed with my ability to speak English as well as you can, because what I was told that Russians, because of the dissimilarities of their languages, would not be able to reduce the accent to the minimum that I still have.
We talk a lot about the Martha story and how that's based on actual stories of KGB illegals who married secretaries and other women mm-hmm. in those positions. And for some reason, most of those Romeos, as they called them, mm-hmm. were East Germans mm. rather than Russians.
Well, Marcus Wolf, who was the Stasi, the head of the foreign intelligence section of the Stasi, he used a lot of Romeos. I mean, I read his autobiography. That was one of the biggest the way of gathering intelligence. I don't know to what extent the KGB did that and to what extent it was done here. I'm sure there was some. Huh.
The Jenningses, one of the things that really strikes me, they never seem to be afraid of their handler or the center or anyone above them. They don't seem to have any fear of anyone more senior than them in the KGB. They're very confident. Did you share that kind of confidence? I mean, because in most jobs, you're a little bit afraid of your boss. And yet it seems they never seem to be.
I was more afraid of my bosses in corporate America. In the course of ordinary interaction, there was never any fear. And it was the fear was not injected from their end either. It was a very collegial type of relationship. And these were they were highly educated people, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I guarantee you, these were not the types of people that went around killing people. So what you have in your characters, you have a fusion of the real bad guys and the intellectuals.
Hmm. Right.
Right. And that makes sense.
And a little bit of Romeo and Juliet in going.
That too, yeah. Makes me cringe, by the way.
Really?
Although we talk about the fact that, when we first saw Jack's story and we saw how close he became with the FBI agent, mm-hmm. It's interesting that that has a little bit of a parallel in our
right,
story.
Right, because as I sure. understand it, you, an FBI agent, moved next door to you just like the mm-hmm. Stan moves.
No, that wasn't Joe. That was somebody else. It was actually a male and a female. Uh-huh. They pretended to be a married couple and they would actually go to work in the morning and then come back.
By this point, they were on to you.
They were observing me. They were onto me simply because of the Matrokin notes had my name, so they knew that I was here as an illegal, but they didn't know what I was still doing, if anything.
Because this is after the fall of the...
Oh, yes, Soviet Union. It was, I think, seven or 8 years after I sent them the goodbye letter. It's not a real defection in the sense that I didn't contacted the authorities.
You just quit.
I just quit, yeah.
So you quit, you stayed here, and then years later, yep. the FBI gets some information that you're an illegal, and that's ironically after you've quit.
Correct. And that raises an interesting question in that, you know, I quit because I could not see myself leave my one-year-old daughter at the time. The question that I can't answer in my mind, if the FBI had caught that window where I could have been turned before I quit, if they had caught me sort of
what would you
6 months prior, would I have, I don't know, I can't say.
Hmm.
It's a good chance that I would have succeeded, but they didn't know me then.
Right, and it was too late once.
Yeah, when, at that point, you know, I was useless. You know, I couldn't possibly tell the Russians, oh, by the way, I'm back.
Yeah, but how is it to quit the KGB? I mean, you're here, you're an illegal, you're an important asset, and you just say,
well, it was a little
very
scary.
Nice working with you. I'm going to be flexible on the retirement package, but I'm done.
Well, it's,
dental benefits, could you keep those?
Well, benefits
you
was...
Always go there.
I know.
Well, I came up with probably the best way of telling them that I was serious and at the same time also telling them that I really didn't mean any harm because I told them I had contracted AIDS. And AIDS was a death sentence and it wasn't something you don't want to let anybody with AIDS into your country. They were deathly afraid of this disease, and it was quite justified. You know, it was communicable, and it was a death sentence. And they bought it.
How did you know they bought it?
Because in the same letter, I told them that you know I wasn't going to contact American authorities. And oh, by the way, please give the money that has been saved on my account, which was a fortune by East German standards, was about $60,000 to my wife. Well, they gave her the money. So that means they bought it. And they also told her that I died from AIDS. I got that feedback after, you know, I got reconnected with my son who knew the story, as I just told you, to be true then, that I was, you know, so.
Joe and Joel, it must seem like vindication or something when you hear that for Jack, such a big part of the reason that he stayed was about children and family, which is kind of why you have Elizabeth and Philip so torn about leaving or staying and the future, right?
I think the truth is we build a lot of our story just by thinking about human beings. So it does feel good, but also it's not surprising because we know that spies are people. So you're on safe territory if you treat them as such.
Yeah.
And I think also the other thing is you hear about him talking about how his name was revealed in the Matrokhin archive. Uh-huh. Well, that archive, and particularly the way it was described in a series of books by the British historian Christopher Andrew, is available to us. We've used it extensively. Mm. We know most of what we know about illegals from that book, so we've been able to build from that resource. Mm-hmm. And putting that together, there's a lot in there to work with as well.
Yeah. So again, in the Americans, there's been this ongoing sort of struggle of like, maybe their handlers saying, you need to go home, it's too dangerous, you need to go home. But the thing that keeps them here is their children, but also you get the sense that maybe for Philip especially.
He likes a good life.
He likes it here. I mean, you must have been a good communist when you were recruited. I mean, was there this process of converting, as it were, to capitalism? Or?
Well, I was a good communist when I was recruited. I was a good communist for the most part while I was still here. I turned into a good socialist.
Bernie would be proud.
Slippery slope.
I don't want to share with you where I wound up. You might get scared. I'm not joining the militia. So, but anyway, there was from very early on, there was a dichotomy in that, you know, I was working on bringing down the system whose products I enjoyed very much. Mm. But that was not enough for me to doubt the communist ideal or even the idea that eventually communism will win over. What really created a big chink in the armor was after almost 15 years of not being part of a team, I became a member of a team that was really functioning very well. So, you know, I was became a computer programmer, and I worked on a team with a whole bunch of really smart guys in a very caring environment. You know, the old style insurance company that really took care of you cradle to grave, almost like a communist state. And I really felt at home here. That, but once I defected, so to speak, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to any of these things. You know, I had a family to take care of. I put this all aside. But my move away from communism only really was completed until I started really thinking about things. And it had a lot to do with, you know, being caught by the FBI, being interrogated, yeah, being questioned, and like starting to reflect as to, you know, where I came from and what reality is nowadays. So
I read somewhere that the FBI actually caught you, so to speak, when you yelled, when you're having an argument with your wife and you yelled that you were a spy and they were listening in and they overheard it. Is that true?
That is indeed true. Yes. It's,
yeah. Was that when your wife found out for the first time?
That is also true. We had an argument. Actually, it was the context was that we were nearing our 10-year anniversary, and the marriage was sort of like not really working too well, and so we had this. I started a discussion in the kitchen, and my suggestion was, you know what, we never really got married. Why don't we get married? And she's Catholic. Why don't we get married in the church and do that? And it was always back and forth. And, you know, and I figured maybe if I choose the nuclear option and tell her what I sacrificed and to be with her child and her, maybe it would change her attitude about me. So that's when I said, look here, by the way, I did this, and this, and I sacrifice. It's a great scene for a movie, I'm thinking.
Boy, is that a good scene. Whoa.
Yeah.
And what did she say?
And you can't use it. Well, it backfired. You know, I obviously can't recall the details, but she felt that I deceived her. Regardless of, you know, the result and all that,
and you got arrested.
Yeah,
that
well,
was
tell
like
us
really the worst plan ever.
Right. So tell us. So you drop that bombshell, and then how long between that moment and your first talk with the FBI, and how did that come about?
Well, I don't know exactly, but I believe, and this is my friend Joe who led the investigation, said it didn't take much longer after that to get the warrant for my arrest. And And it wasn't officially an arrest. They introduced themselves, and it was a fake traffic stop at a toll gate across at a bridge across the Delaware, and
sort of an isolated area.
There's not a lot of traffic. It's just south of the Delaware Water Gap. That bridge is not much in use, and yeah, they waved me over and some state trooper. I don't know if he was fake or real, but he certainly looked like one. And then Joe came from the background. I didn't even need to look at the credentials. I knew what that was. You know, so
this is Joe Riley.
Joe Riley. Yeah.
And how did you feel when he came in? What did he say? And how did you feel?
Well, he said, "FBI, we would like to talk with you. Could you please follow us and step in the car?" That's now him telling me. At that point, my face lost all color. I turned to completely white. Also, then, based on his recollection, I recovered very quickly. And so, you know, we get in the car, we drive off, and after a couple of minutes, the first question I asked, am I under arrest? And the answer was no. And then, after I digested that, I don't know. I just sort of have that, want to call it a talent or whatever, to make some really silly remarks. I said, "So what took you so long?" That was an icebreaker.
They laughed.
Yeah. Not for long, because they had some serious business to do. They still didn't know, you know, how I would react. But it was. It, from that moment on, the whole atmosphere became
relaxed.
You set a tone.
Yeah, with that.
I did.
Yeah.
mean, that was instinctive. Yeah. I didn't think about it.
It's such a moving story because it all starts with the deepest, such painful places in your heart. I mean, it's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
Does the Americans feel accurate to you? I don't mean like with the wigs and so on. I mean, psychologically, this living with deception and yet trying to have some truth between individuals.
Yeah, that's absolutely the strength of the show. Other than, you know, the artistic value that you can't make an entertaining show about illegals without compressing and, you know, making one or two characters out of many, as well as, you know, compressing the timeline, getting rid of all the boring stuff that you go through, all the waiting and all that.
Right.
So all of this is not so real. The wigs, we talked about this a little bit. You know, there were some people that I trained with, you know, surveillance groups, that they used wigs too.
Yeah.
So I never did. But when it comes down to the psychology of living in another country, pretending to be somebody else, knowing that you're not, is as accurate as I could myself predict, depicted. It's really good. And so when I watched the very first episode, and you know, I think I sent you an email with the responses, I could relate to a lot of that stuff, the emotions and the thoughts that come with that kind of a life.
Can I ask you something to that end? I feel like it's I'm sorry for the cliche part of this question, but when the FBI finally showed up that mm-hmm. day, as terrifying as it was in so many ways, that was there a part of you that was relieved?
To some degree, but what I was really worried about, what would happen to my children.
Right.
I mean, that was the biggest worry. And for, you know, there was a period of about a month during which I had to take a lie detector test. And, you know, until I got sort of a definitive answer what would happen to me, I was stressed.
Right.
So at that point, it was never about me. You know, it sounds like, you know, I'm making myself look better, but... No, but eventually, once we got to a point where the future became clear, yeah, all that, you know, the stuff that I had sort of put way back into my head and like sort of locked up in concrete, I let it out mm-hmm. and let it go, mm-hmm. and but was, you know, this is catharsis is a widely overused word, but what really made me whole was my ability to go back to Germany mm-hmm. and reconnect with my past. And it was worth getting fired over. Because, you know, what the thing is, you know, why are you going public? Well, it has a different feel to it when you get out in front of the world and say, this is who I was, this is who I am, other than just telling a few people in private. So,
well, you spent your whole life not telling anyone
that's
who
right.
you were.
That's right. And now I'm sharing too much.
I don't think that's possible, Jack.
That's it for this week. Thanks again to Jack Barsky, Joel Fields, and Joe Weisberg. Please come back next week to hear us talk about episode 403, Experimental Prototype City of Tomorrow, with more fantastic special guests. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. Our producer is Henry Malofsky. I'm June Thomas. This show is part of the Panoply Network.